FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to and perhaps even watching the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is 11/9/2020. Well, markets are euphoric over something, perhaps the prospect of a vaccine that seems to be promising. And conversely, precious metal markets have been decimated. Well, here to make some sense of the situation is our good friend Rick Rule of Sprott. Rick, always great to have you on. So, interesting times. I guess the Chinese curse is actually, we're living through it, aren't we?
Well, I find them interesting times, Kerry, and I'm not sure that they're a curse. Anybody who has been in financial markets as long as I understands that volatility is part of dealing with financial markets. And in truth, a day like today, where the asset classes that I like most, which is to say precious metals assets, are down substantially, reflects to me something like a sale. Were I shopping for more conventional goods. So from my viewpoint, the volatility that we're seeing is all good. I realize I'm a unique creature, perhaps, in that regard.
Yeah. And so is it good because it's setting up the next move forward? Because we saw a peak August 7th. That was when gold peaked. And now we've kind of been going in a sideways consolidation pattern. It looked like last Friday it was going to break out. Or I should say, I'm sorry, last Thursday, 2 days after the election, Friday, it was unbelievable. Gold and silver each went up 20 cents each. I don't remember when I had seen that last, probably a far less volatile time. And now we see it go down to nearly, you know, mid-80s. Is this just scaring out the weak hands, or what's happening?
I just think that irrespective of the label that people put on it or the reason that they derive for volatility in financial markets, that volatility is inherent in financial markets. We could perhaps say that people are more confident in the economic outlook as a consequence of political certainty. Perhaps people are attracted to the prospect of a COVID drug. I think all those are good. But, you know, I've been involved in precious metals markets for 45 years. And volatility, which is to say cyclical declines in secular bull markets or cyclical rises in secular bear markets, are part of the landscape. The truth is, if you aren't psychologically prepared for these volatile moments, you shouldn't be in the markets. And frankly, from my own viewpoint, with regards to the gold juniors, I was basically frozen out of them midsummer because they went up too far too fast. I have a 45 company shopping list, and the decline in prices has begun to make that shopping list look more attractive to me, which I'm grateful for. You know, Kerry, with my own gold equities, I believe that we're in a secular bull market. And I believe over 3 years or 4 years or 5 years, the market goes much higher, which means that most of my stocks aren't for sale now. The only way that I can transact is if they get cheaper to buy more, because I'm not looking to sell any except for my mistakes at any price close to where they're at. So I'm personally very grateful for today.
Okay. Well, that's definitely putting the lipstick on a pig there, Rick. But I agree with you.
I don't think wanting assets that I want to buy to be priced cheaper is putting lipstick on a pig. I would suspect that wanting to overpay is putting lipstick on a pig. It means that you don't have the courage of your convictions and you'd rather sell than buy. I'd rather buy than sell. So it's in my interest to see the stocks go lower.
I agree with you. And they're due for a pullback. One thing I know that you know is that all of these companies with any kind of positive prospects have all been raising millions and millions of dollars in private placements. Whereas, you know, 2 years ago, they were counting paper clips and begging for dollars, you know, playing that game. Now it's now they were playing the game of send me your check or drop off your check today or you're out. And so that alone really should have told us, and I felt for a while that stuff was getting a little bit too high and it was time for a price decline.
Agreed. Agreed.
Yeah. So now, though, and another thing, that virtually every gold deposit on the planet became theoretically economically feasible, right? Most of them will never get drilled. We know that. But for a shining moment, every deposit in the world became profitable. And that's, when was the last time that happened, Rick?
Oh, well, I suspect you answered your own question. Never. and we're still in never. Narrative notwithstanding, people are going to have to exercise discipline and intelligence speculating in this market.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of companies do you think the next phase of the bull market is going to favor? Obviously, near producers look like they're kind of sitting in the catbird seat. But what kind of explorers, who do you see really being the beneficiary of the next move?
I think, frankly, that the next move will be in quality above the level that you're describing. I think it'll be middle market companies that are generating substantial free cash flow that trade at valuation discounts to larger companies, where either the valuation discount will disappear or they'll be taken over.
Interesting. So
I think in terms of exploration, we've had so little exploration in the last 10 years that there is a dearth of advanced exploration projects. Anybody who makes a decent discovery will be re-rated by the market. And anybody who makes what threatens to be a high tier two or a tier one deposit, I think will be taken out at eye-popping multiples. I think that those opportunities will be rare. And I think that most of the people playing the market don't have the sophistication to judge what a tier two or tier one deposit is. So you're also going to see narrative operate in this market. And you're going to see, as you saw this summer, companies that spend $1 million in financial public relations polishing up the narrative that are able to raise $20 or $30 million, ultimately to the chagrin of the people who put the $20 or $30 million up.
Mm-hmm. So just for the sake of people out there listening who aren't as sophisticated as we'd hope, just define a tier one and a tier two deposit for them.
To me, a tier one deposit is a deposit with 5 million ounces of reserve and resource that is capable of producing over 400,000 ounces a year. I'm less fussy about jurisdiction than some of my competitors. I'll take a good deposit, a lousy jurisdiction, over the reverse of that. A tier two deposit, I think, should be 1.5 to 2 million ounces and capable of producing a minimum of 150,000 ounces a year.
Okay, that's a reasonable definition, and it's easy. Once you have that definition, it's pretty easy to find these companies because there aren't very many, right?
Correct.
But the companies with free cash flow, are they going to be trading higher for their takeover value, or are they going to be trading higher for their profitability, or both?
I think both. I think if not the latter, then eventually the former, which is to say that very big valuation gaps are beginning to appear between the best of the best, the top tier multi-asset producers, and the smaller companies, particularly single asset companies, which are perceived rightly as being more risky. Value-oriented investors will begin to come down the value chain as the free cash flow in some of these smaller companies makes the company managements decide how to return capital to shareholders, either via dividends or via share buybacks. If that doesn't happen in the next 18 to 24 months, my suspicion is that those same second-tier producers that are building up cash fast will be taken over either horizontally by other smaller companies or by larger companies. Sort of like the old Pure Later oil filter commercial, Carrie. You can pay me now or you can pay.
Yeah. So then I guess the chase is on for these companies to acquire. We're, I guess, just beginning to see the beginning wave of M&A activity. What is going to be, besides a gold price $500 higher than it is, what's going to be the precipitative catalytic event where we just see this market go crazy?
Institutional, in terms of takeovers, institutional investors need to begin to make themselves familiar with the fact that there are some competent gold mining company managements. The M&A boom that we saw in the last decade, which is 2000 to 2010, saw many billions of dollars wasted on bad takeovers. The institutional investor right now would like to see the free cash flow return to shareholders because they don't trust managements to deploy it. You are beginning to see intelligently crafted mergers that are accretive mergers. I think you'll continue to see that. And I think that you'll see the market capitalizations of merged companies where the mergers were intelligently created react well, which will begin to give managers the latitude to do more of this type of activity.
Okay. So when we look, is it, you know, this sector really doesn't get valued based on PE ratio, right? Do you think we'll get to the point where people actually look at mining company PE ratios and value them accordingly?
Well, PE is never as important rationally in mining as PNAV. Remember that the E goes away as a deposit gets smaller. So you have to derive a net present value calculation around a deposit or a series of deposits to accurately value a company. So I don't suspect that unless the generalist investor really comes into mining who doesn't understand the terminal nature of deposits, that PE will ever be the predominant characteristic. I think potential exploration leverage and recycle ratio, which is to say the ability of companies to redeploy free cash flow in an accretive measure, PNAV, which is to say net present value, and optionality. If the market comes to expect the gold price to go up by $500, some investors will begin to look for companies that would exhibit outsized gains in response to an increase in precious metals price, the so-called optionality trade.
Okay, so here's a question for you. The future of royalty companies, when really they're specialty finance companies, right? Sprouts runs one. And basically, when it was hard to raise capital by these companies, then you could kind of, you had a lot more leverage, put it that way, a lot more say over the terms. Now, these companies are getting money thrown at them from various directions, and it's much more competitive and harder to find the really good deals. What does that mean for the royalty sector?
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Arcana Corporation is on the verge of bringing the world's highest grade silver mine into production. The Revenue Virginius mine in Colorado has proven improbable silver reserves grading nearly 37 ounces per ton silver with an all-in sustaining production cost of only $8 per ounce of silver. The mine is fully permitted with infrastructure already in place, and the company has announced they plan to commence production in 2020. Achieving successful production usually results in a significant upward share price re-rating on the Lassonde curve. Arcana trades under the ticker AUN in Toronto and AUNFF in New York. To learn more, go to arcana.com. That's A-U-R-C-A-N-A.com.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
I think the higher quality royalty companies will continue to prosper. I think they'll continue to prosper in substantial measure because of the valuation disparities between precious metals cash flows and base metals cash flows, which is to say that very large streaming transactions will take place where base metals companies monetize the cash flow from their precious metal streams. These transactions can take place at 12 to 15 times EBIT, whereas that same cash flow, if it occurred in a zinc producer or a copper producer, would be valued at 5 or 6 times EBIT. So I think you'll see in the next 2 or 3 years a series of very, very large transactions where base metals producers, including very large ones, monetize all or part of their precious metals co-product stream to the streaming companies to the benefit of both parties.
All right. So it's still there. But I guess what we're seeing, what we're witnessing is 8-10 years ago, this was not a rational market in the sense that you couldn't just look up prices effectively. But now we're getting to a point where the market is becoming rational, which means margins are kind of shrinking a bit.
Yes, I think the sector is competitive. I'm not sure that the margins are becoming rational because of rationality. I think the margins might be becoming rational because of the extraordinarily low cost of capital enjoyed by the royalty and streaming space. It's become extremely competitive. And so yields have been bid down fairly substantially, except in very large transactions.
All right. So here's another question for you that a listener recently asked me, and that is, what about the concept of private equity funds, hedge funds, taking out companies, taking them private effectively, and pretty much just buying up companies and just they become part of the hedge fund's portfolio?
I think with the free cash yields that you're beginning to see in precious metals, and the margins that are also enjoyed by some base metals companies, that the scenario that you suggest is a very real possibility. Some of the best operators in the world in the mining business have always been private, which is to say family-run operations that have never seen the light of public markets. The levels of free cash generation and also the extraordinarily low cost of debt currently is a situation made in heaven for private equity investors.
All right. And that could be, and there's a plethora of them, not just hedge funds, but sovereign wealth funds. You can kind of just take your pick, right? There's a lot of money sitting on the sidelines. And this opportunity isn't going to go unnoticed, right?
You know, Kerry, the cynic in me says that one of the catalysts for this will be the extraordinary amount of money that's been raised in private equity funds. And the fact that if it goes undeployed for 2 years or 3 years, they have to give it back to the investors and give up the management fee. It may be that managers' greed and larceny ends up to be the driving factor in the circumstance that you described.
Hey, well, when I was a lawyer and we had to give back a retainer, that was ruled unconstitutional. You know, it's like, you never give back a retainer. Do something for that money. It's in your account. Obviously, ethically, you got to give some back. But the beauty is that hedge fund managers and other ne'er-do-wells really aren't constrained by the, as my former partner used to call it, the canyon of ethics, the canyons of ethics. So it's either use it or lose it. And once they're locked in, and so there's going to be some type of gold rush, I guess, is what I'm asking you, is we're just going to see at some point there's an aha moment where, like, anybody with any money in the planet looks at the sector as well as physical bullion and says, this is where I need to be.
I'm not sure that happens, Kerry, but pretty clearly the policy perspective of governments around the world has been to debase the currency. And so some number of investors are going to look at that and say, you know what, I have to be in precious metals. And it doesn't have to be a large number because the constituency for precious metals is so small. It doesn't have to be an avalanche of support. It just needs to be a bigger trickle.
Yeah, a bigger trickle. Like, we're talking crumbs, but bigger crumbs.
I read a study, I think it was by J.P. Morgan Chase, about 18 months ago, that suggested that the market share of precious metals and precious metals related investment assets had a less than 0.5% market share among savings and investment assets in the United States. That's down from a 3-decade mean of between 1.5% and 2%. So I don't think that mean reversion is too much to ask for.
All right. So you heard, obviously, I know you heard this, that the Ohio Police and Firemen's Pension said we're putting 5% of our assets into gold. And I mean, it's kind of in the terms of public pension funds, it's kind of a minor player. It's not substantial. But it was kind of like when I think it was a while ago, they said 10 years ago that the University of Texas was going to put part of their endowment into gold. Is it one of those moments where all of a sudden we see a lot of Johnny-come-latelys into the sector?
I think yes. You know, at Sprott, we've been talking to very large pensions and endowments for 10 years. The difference is now that they're calling us back. They're writing checks. They used to take the meetings out of either curiosity or politeness. Suddenly, among some, there's interest. And among others, there's deployment. So we're certainly seeing the largest investors in the world, particularly those investors who have traditionally been long bond centric, who understand that with a negative real interest rate, that their carry on their traditional investments is negative. It's difficult to pay benefits to beneficiaries 30 years from now if you have a negative carry.
Yeah, for sure. And clearly, real negative interest rates in the U.S. and nominal negative interest rates around the rest of the world is a wake-up call to these investors who literally watch their capital dissolve before their very eyes. It's kind of like a magic trick. You kind of go there, and rather than pulling a rabbit out of the hat, he puts the rabbit in the hat, never to be seen again, right?
Correct. A real challenge. You know, my partner, John Hathaway, has pointed out publicly that about $100 trillion worldwide is managed by institutional investors. Their mantra traditionally has been 60% equity, 40% debt. Some of that 40% is going to have to be redeployed simply because the negative yield obviates the traditional hedge. I'm not saying that $40 trillion is going to come into gold. I'm not saying anything like that. All I'm trying to say is that some of it is going to have to go elsewhere. And I think gold will get its fair share.
Yeah, just makes sense. Now, as the perpetually frustrated silver bull that I am, and I don't mean to say perpetually, because I understand it's a market and there's bulls and there's bears. But now, clearly, we're at the beginning of a bull market. Gold is at or near its all-time highs. Silver is 50% of the way there. When does my patience, and I'm not known as a patient person, except when it comes to doing this business, because I've been at it 10 years, but when does my patience get rewarded?
Well, Kerry, if the second quarter of last year wasn't sufficient for you, there's no hope. You need to see a therapist.
That's what my therapist told me.
My experience has been that, first of all, as volatile as gold is, silver is substantially more volatile, which is to say that its pullbacks are more dramatic than gold's pullback. But secondly, in prior bull markets, gold has had to leave. When silver picks up steam, it moves further and it moves faster. It's my belief that what you're seeing now is a cyclical decline in a secular bull market. I might be wrong, but I don't think I am. And if you examine prior bull markets, what you'll see is that index pullbacks, which is to say not the worst stocks in the market, but the market as a whole, frequently pulls back by 15 or 20 or 25% by way of cyclical declines in secular bull markets. The fact that it frustrates market watchers is interesting, but not particularly relevant. That's all I can say. People who don't want to get bucked shouldn't participate in rodeos.
Yeah, well, then you're never going to win the purse, obviously.
Correct.
You're never going to win the prize. And I was being a little facetious, but I remember, not to flatter you, you are the one of the most savviest people in this sector. And I remember you telling me, without any lack of confidence, not talking your own book, you said, I've been through three of these secular bulls before. I've deployed my assets because I know the fourth is coming. Now, it took some time, but clearly it was worth the wait.
You know, if I were to catalog my investing sins, one of them would be that I consistently confuse the words inevitable, which I always get right, with imminent, which I normally get wrong. So I tend to be 2 or 3 years early most of the time.
Well, if you can afford to be early, that's great. But the old saw on Wall Street is there's nothing worse than being right at the wrong time, because that can break you being wrong at the right time, I guess, if that's such a
thing. You have to have psychological staying power, not merely financial staying power. And the truth is that prior bull markets, Gary, have treated me extraordinarily well. And I've learned that they're worth waiting for. And, you know, I'll just leave it there. They're worth waiting for.
All right. And I think we will leave it at that. people want to find out about you, how do they subscribe to your daily missive?
I'll give everybody an incentive to do so. If you go to a web address, sprotusa.com/rankings, at that website, you can enter the names of your natural resource stocks, the ones that you own, and I personally will rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. And I'll comment on individual issues where I think my comments might have value. In addition, I will include, for those who request it, a 50-year gold equities chart, the Barron's Gold Mining Index, and a 100-year commodity chart that talks about the valuation of commodities relative to other asset classes in the economy. Once again, SprotUSA/ranking.
All right. And there's a notation in the show notes. You just got to click that link. It'll take you right there. Use it, because to get a person's expertise, the level that Rick is at, I mean, you just don't look a gift horse in the mouth. Just take it, because you'll learn some things that you didn't know, for sure, as I have over the years from our informal association here, Rick. It's always great to have you on. Any questions or comments for Rick, just write me kl@kerrylutz.com. I will forward them off to Rick. We will get you an answer. And go over to the website, sign up for the free newsletter, financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Now more than ever, Rick, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Kerry. Thank you.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.